Welcome back, everybody, to the TV Talk Machine podcast. I am your co-host, Jason Snell, and across the internet from me, your host, chief TV critic at The Hollywood Reporter, fresh back from Beverly Hills, where he was doing the death march with cocktails, and he's ready to report in because he survived again, amazingly. It's Tim Goodman. Hello.
Hey, Jason.
Good to have you back. Good to see that you made it through another one. I didn't call the switchboard. I didn't try to reach you last week.
It was probably for the best. But, you know, it's funny because it's not like I didn't, you know, we have to retitle it. It was or somebody called it, I think it was Near Death March with cocktails. Because I was only there for like 7 or 8 days.
Yeah, so it was like a whirlwind with cocktails instead.
Yeah, it was a stroll.
That's not bad. So you did the streaming and cable and skipped on broadcast.
Yes, I skipped on broadcast on PBS, which is unfortunate. It was just the timing of that. And the way that it used to be every single cable channel was in the cable block. But once you have vertical integration, that sort of ceased. But the only thing I missed was FX, which was actually took place this morning on the day we are taping this. And so I only missed them, but I went to dinner with all their execs the second night I was down there. So I kind of had the access and everything that I needed to do. I kind of, you know, their announcements about Fargo season 4 with Chris Rock and a couple of other things were fine. And, you know, I missed a table read for It's Always Sunny and stuff like that. But the actual like stuff that I needed from the executives I got before they came down there. So really the only one of note that I'm missing is Showtime, which will fall under the CBS network umbrella.
They don't have much to talk about at CBS, so I'm sure it'll be fine.
I think that they're going to be wanting to be saying, let's talk about Showtime.
Yeah, it's funny. So on my podcast download this week, we had Natalie Jarvi, the sort of tech reporter at The Hollywood Reporter, basically.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And she was telling the story about how I asked her about, you know, Facebook Watch and YouTube Premium and that you, you wrote a column about it, too. That's very good. And I said, yeah, that Facebook Watch, that sounded like that went really well. And she said, you got to understand the setup, like, these people are used to being in these kind of adoring, they get applause. People were really excited to see them. And then they come to the TCA and it's just a very cold room, like literally very, very well air conditioned, full of TV critics who are just kind of giving you the eye and not applauding or doing anything. And and that can be a harsh greeting if you're not prepared for it, which she said the Facebook Watch people were not.
Yeah, they did not seem to be prepared for that. No,
no, they're waiting for. I said to her, I was like, it's Comic-Con adulation, and then the next week you're like, nobody's applauding me. But it's a tough room. That's just how it is. You got to get used to
it. Weirdly, it was only 3 or 4 people mentioned that there was no clapping, that there had been no clapping. It was cold. You know, that's kind of fading out. But, you know, it's always I've never gone to a TCA tour where that was not mentioned.
There's always somebody new who doesn't understand the rules. And
the streak is alive. Yeah.
So when you talk to Fox people, did they talk at all? I'm curious about the... so it sounds like this is a done deal now. It's got to be approved and closed and all that. But the Fox-Disney thing is kind of a done deal. Are they able to... Are they kind of mentally preparing for it? Are they waiting until everything is done before they make any changes? Did they talk about that at all?
I talked to only the FX people, not the separate Fox people.
Right.
Because I think that Fox is in a different... Yeah.
Well, right. Fox Broadcast is staying with the Murdochs,
yes,
so right? But
yeah,
FX is going to go to Disney.
Yeah, I think it's too early for that. But I do think that Hulu presents them with some really interesting opportunities. Because it looks like it's going to come to fruition, that thing where that Disney will be putting their more... certainly all of FX's harsher stuff will end up on Hulu. But Disney now has as the outlet, like we talked about, to put their edgier fare over onto Hulu.
Right.
And, you know, and I still think there's a lot of stuff that's undone in that deal. Like we could still see Comcast sell its share to Disney in
the rumor is that part of the maybe a gentleman's agreement that may be happening is that Comcast will sell their part of Hulu. This is just a rumor, but or speculation maybe even sell their part of Hulu to Disney in exchange for Disney not bidding on or selling their part of Sky. the broadcaster in the UK, that they both have been bidding for, that there might be a, like, you take Hulu, we'll take Sky kind of carving up of these various assets. And that would give Disney 90% of Hulu, at which point, like, Time Warner Cable has 10%. But basically, that would give them complete control over Hulu, and then they could do a, you know, an international Hulu rollout with all of their content, and then, yeah, we'll see. But that's a year away, probably.
That's still a year. And there's some question about why Comcast would want to do that, because, you know, losing out on this, like, this, you know, they need to come up with their own streaming service.
Well, that is true. All of the Comcast content has to go somewhere. And right now, Hulu is at least a thing they own 30% of. And, you know, I think in the long run, everybody's going to want to try at least to run their own thing. But right now, they don't have their own thing, right? So, I don't know. It's do they want to share space with Disney on Hulu? I don't know.
And I don't think, you know, it was not a great, it turned out to be a really interesting experiment and a successful one for everybody who got into it from the network side, who said, well, okay, we needed to do this thing where images are going to be sent through the internet, which we don't really know about. So, but we're going to invest in this company. So this Netflix thing that's small over here doesn't take on the world. Take over the world, which it did.
Yeah.
But, you know, they got into it and it was smart. They didn't like it at the time. They did not like all to be in the same bed. I don't think that in 2018, Comcast really wants to be in the same bed in Hulu with what will be Disney. So selling their share does make sense, because they're already going to lose out on any voting anyway. That's a 60, you know, it's a 60% advantage for Disney. So it does make a lot of sense to sort of give things up.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what's happening with that. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the whole Facebook YouTube thing? I mean, you wrote a column about it. It's pretty good. I liked your takeaway, which is that nobody is particularly afraid of either of them in the way that, like, Netflix has obviously become a huge player. But the impression I got from your column is that at least YouTube seems to have hired competent, capable people who are going to try to do content, you know, premium content for them. Whether people want to subscribe to YouTube and, like, the YouTube brand can carry that off, I think, is a real open question. But it sounds like, you know, at least they've got people who know what they're doing. Whereas I got the distinct impression that the Facebook stuff, they're just flailing everywhere and who knows what the heck they're doing, and nobody seems particularly worried about them.
Yeah, I marked the Facebook Watch and YouTube Premium appearance at TCA as, when I tried to outline this in the column, I marked that as sort of the end of, like, the official end of the bogeyman and everybody's big worry in the industry about, quote unquote, the internet and these rivals. I think it was, you know, there's still worry, but I think that was a definitive end to it, because Facebook Watch does not have its act together. They already know that they're years away. They know that they're really not going to compete in the prestige or even scripted drama area. And I think the networks are less worried. They were not worried about competing financially with Facebook. They were worried about pulling eyeballs away. And I don't think that there's any, you know, they're like, okay, if you want to pay people based on their Facebook followers or their social media followers and their how many likes the show gets and the streaming hearts that roll up during the show as it goes, go for it. Because everybody else in the real world of Hollywood knows there's no money behind that. So Facebook, which has money, is just throwing it away to create, you know, they're just burning it to create this Facebook Watch thing. So they're fine. YouTube is basically doing the same thing, but they're a little more organized and professional. They have Suzanne Daniels, who has lots of experience in the TV industry, in front of it. But even that, like, they just know that the shows are getting better. There's definitely one called Origins that I want to look at that looked really professional, but I would want to see an actual episode or five to see if they can pull it off. And even if they do pull it off, Jason, you and I know that, like, that doesn't mean anyone's going to watch it. So these guys are really at their baby steps. And I think the anxiety is now off the table for everybody else in the game, because they're like, okay, these are total internet behemoths. And yet they're barely dipping their toe in it. And what they're doing is not going to threaten us. And it doesn't look like they're going to threaten us for 3 or 4 years. And by then, game over, probably. So, and certainly Facebook Watch wants to compete more in a unscripted space. And I just don't see YouTube Premium, even if they have a good show, getting subscribers to do it. So we'll see. It was really interesting in that respect.
Yeah, in the long run, like, YouTube Premium is such a complicated idea. It used to be YouTube Red. You get it's bundled with their music service. So if you already have like Spotify or something, they're trying to get you to pay. It's not a bad deal as a bundle, but it's $13 a month just to, you know, for a show or two. It seems like a tough sell. It sounds, what Natalie was telling me was that it sounds like if you get YouTube TV, which is their over the top, you also get their originals. So there is kind of another direction. It sounds like they're placing a bunch of different bets here, and I wouldn't count out Google to eventually figure out what it wants, but it's still clearly just trying to figure it out.
Right.
As opposed to, first off, there's Apple, which, you know, I'm gonna lay down a prediction here that you might actually get Apple at the TCA next summer. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't that be something? If
we
that happened,
them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you did get the new head of Amazon this time. So how was that? How did that go?
It went better than I thought it was going to go. And I actually also met with Jennifer Salke from Amazon, and it, you know, she joked that, you know, there's been no love lost when she was at, NBC. And so she even said, well, cause I was wishing her luck, and I do like a number of Amazon shows. And she kind of was laughing that she saw one of my tweets about Patriot, or as we say, Sad Spies being renewed, and thought that was interesting. And as we were talking, she's like, "Well, maybe now you won't hate me." So it's that's how you see how my press tours go, by the way.
Wow.
But yeah, there's a lot of that, and they were really well organized. I think that their upcoming slate is really strong. I think that there's a couple of other people on her development team who are smart as well. I think there's a deeper bench. We even saw some people who weren't. I know that there are people who are working at Amazon who are smart, who weren't even at TCA. I think there's a really good team in place. They're producing interesting content, and they're aware of a couple of big glitches. And I brought them up repeatedly, one in the session with a couple of questions to her, and then also in private with them. And that is, their user interface is terrible,
right.
And they're working on fixing that right now. They have a prototype that they're toying with, that they've shown Salke, and she's looking at it. And they're also aware that, like, you know, it's hard to find, they've done a better job, but it's hard to find their own originals. So the idea of maybe spending some money to promote themselves outside of the platform and maybe within it is also necessary. And they're just basically admitted that they're going to do away with the whole like fake fan voting and people
right.
can, yeah, they're, so they're just going to be moving forward. And I just think that they're a much more cohesive approach. And I think that some of their people, you know, we joke, people have joked in this thing that it, as on our podcast, of course, is that this black hole at Amazon. And I think that you're going to start seeing that. I don't really believe that, as you know, but I think you're going to start seeing that perception change in the next year.
All right. Yeah, I think that they got a lot of potential there. I think they're going to be what they should be, right? Which is a legitimate contender and competitor to Netflix. So,
yeah.
What else? What else jumped out at you from the press tour that it's worth talking about?
Well, I think that that's certainly I think that's my future. I'm not interested in the network side. Mm. I mean, comedies, but you know, and there's value to be there when there's maybe a good network comedy coming through. It's really kind of interesting, I think, in the big picture of sort of how TCA works. I'm vested in this because I've been doing it for so long, but I could definitely see a period where the networks are not getting enough out of this. And so they let's say like FX and Showtime shift back over and do kind of a mini half day, or, well, FX could do a full day, but because they do a full day on their own anyway, they're just in that back to back with Fox. But I could see FX doing their own day inside the cable platform, and possibly Showtime doing that as well. Because I see a bigger splinter. It's maybe, you know, I'm obviously biased because I believe that that's where we're going in the future. And I, you know, maybe CBS All Access would have been really interesting to hear about, but, I was just happy to sort of be in the cable and streaming portion because I think that's where all the action is. And there's definitely still value there. I think there's some interesting stuff coming up on Nat Geo and Discovery and stuff like that. Well, Discovery's out of the scripted game, which I find really interesting. Mm. So you're starting to see some early recession of that. Some people are kind of getting out of the game. Discovery was a big one, even though it kind of got buried in all the announcements. You know, I really valued the experience, but I was kind of happy to be in and out within, you know, a week or 8 days. And I got all the stuff that I needed to get done, and I can still be in contact with people. I would say the one thing that I took away from talking to executives there is that they have really settled into the new reality, Jason. They're less anxious about lack of overnight ratings or even ratings within 2 weeks. And they're just like, and they know that the competition is fierce. They're all like, this is our new world. We can't bitch and moan about it. We just have to find a way to redefine what success is in this landscape. And I think they're doing that. And maybe the one thing that came out that I got from people, I talked to a number of people outside of just HBO and FX, and that was that the numbers are moving. This is kind of frightening to me. The numbers are moving in a direction where at some point it's going to crest 50%, because apparently it's close, especially for a number of people, where more than 50% of the audience is watching outside of a 30-day window rather than inside. That is astonishing.
I get it. I get it, mm-hmm. because I just started watching Luke Cage yesterday.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right? And I've got a bunch of stuff that's piled up that I, you know, I'm making my way through Killing Eve now. Right?
Mm-hmm. Like, yes. Mm-hmm.
This is all. And the reality is, as we talk about every week, there's so much out there. And people, I think a lot of people have gotten into the idea because of binging on Netflix, especially, of having things kind of like collect. And then yes. going through mm-hmm. Making your own binge, at which point you're pushing it. If it's like a show that runs for 10 weeks, you're waiting 10 weeks, maybe longer, because you got other stuff you're watching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like that 30-day window. Well, you know, if you think about it, like, people are not familiar with, you know, it used to be overnight ratings and then it was live plus 7. So you right. wanted it in the first week. And then people were kind of discounting, like, can you still be paid in 2 weeks? The fact that like cable and streamers are talking now about, you know, the majority of their audience outside of the 30-day window, that is wild, because that's going to shake up how you do the ad world.
Right. Right. I mean, what do you even, I mean, that what a thing, right? To say, well, mm-hmm. you know, you can put an ad on this show, but people aren't going to see it for like a month. What do you advertise then?
But, you know, here's the interesting thing about it. As I look at it, I think it though that hurts the shows, or theoretically on the surface, because it's a flip-flop of how the system has been set up, it does put the onus on advertising agencies and you know, their representatives, because you're still getting lots of eyeballs to these shows eventually. And so there's still merit if you can still pull in 5 million people. That's still pretty good these days when it's all on all platforms. And if you can chase them around with an ad that maybe has a little bit more, you know, evergreen feel to it, it could still work. But yeah, it's going to be a big, big change.
Wow. What a world we live in. I mean, I don't even know how you, other than, I mean, if you're doing traditional broadcast, that's tough. It's a tough thing if you've got ads, because nobody wants to sell you an ad unless you can dynamically insert, which is what, you know, on demand could do. But if you're mm-hmm. if somebody's recording a broadcast, like, the ads are not the same in a month. That's a tough sell for them.
That is a tough sell.
Seeing the whole business model just unravel in front of us, aren't we? I should mention, you and Dan did a little piece about the musts and busts of summer 2018, and I was going to ask you about that, because you guys had some interesting observations, and also my observation, which is, I know that we have a year-round programming cycle here, sort of, and mm-hmm. yet this summer I have felt kind of adrift. I have felt like you can still feel that most of the outlets are not making much of an effort this time of year. You can feel it. There's not a lot out there.
Yeah, and it's I mean, there's stuff out there, but it's not. I think, you know, if we went back 10 years, we'd say, oh, this is still a busy summer. But if we did that, you'd have to take away all the other stuff that we drowned through just to get to the summer. So, you know, we've been pelted by shows for, you know, basically 9 months, and now you're getting into 8 or 9 months, and you're getting to the summer, and it feels like there's less of it because there is. And the fact is that, you know, you don't need a genius to tell you that eyeballs go away in the summer because people are on vacation. They're not watching. It's lighter out later, and people are like not around. And you couple that with the fact that it's peak TV and streaming and this 30-day window. Yeah, there's it's hard to sort of build an audience, but that's one of the interesting things to me. It's like, I still think there's value in HBO's Succession, because in a less crowded field, let's put it that way, it's going to be discovered. And I think more and more people are coming to that. HBO was talking about how more and more people come into that every week, and then word of mouth spreads. And so they get kind of a slow summer build, which they might not get if they had another 20 shows premiering.
Yeah, I mean, that's the advantage. We just talked about people feeling overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. This is the time when people aren't overwhelmed. So that's I know it's counter-programming and you're risking having no eyeballs there, but at the same time, it's also, you may catch people's eye when they otherwise wouldn't. It's a risk.
We found more than enough shows to talk about, you know, but some of them were things like, the hidden gems and things that I have been digging up, and they weren't not all the stuff that I was talking about outside of Lodge 49 were, super current and glow. Right.
Hey, we should talk about Lodge 49 because we talked about it like a month ago when your review came out. Your review posted July 17th. The air date is August 6th, so we're just about there. And we should remind people they can go back and listen to that episode where we talked about Lodge 49 a few weeks ago. But just to remind people, it's on AMC. It's quirky. It's
whimsical.
Yeah, and you liked it.
It did. It's weirdly hopeful in a kind of bleak story. Not bleak like Better Call Saul, which also premieres its fourth season, and I reviewed that, and that came out today. So we'll have links to both of them, but they're going to come out in the same day. So you're going to see Saul is at 9 o'clock, and then Lodge 49 is at 10 o'clock. I like that pairing because, you know, both shows move slow, and, you know, AMC is actually a believer that when people there, this was also mentioned at TCA, I should put out there, from David Madden, their guy, who's basically saying, you know, when people are overwhelmed, this is really touching on what you said, Jason, so I'm kind of burying the lead here on this reveal, is that AMC is like, what we're finding is that when people are overwhelmed, they like a really good story that they can be patient with and just stick with. And so Saul, you know, despite the fact that it unfolds very slowly, was like the third ranked cable series of the year behind like Walking Dead and something else. So it's like, you know, there's real viewers out there for people who like their storytelling in depth. And so the pacing of Lodge 49, which also is kind of like laid back, I think fits well. And the mood of it, which is, you know, this down on his luck kind of surfer guy, loses his father and has an injury and kind of just is just like going through life with, you know, even he's got that feeling of the life, the glass being half full, when it's actually his life is kind of half empty. And so there's this positivity to it. And there's a whimsical element of the lodge. And I did ask, by the way, this is for people who did hear us talk about the lodge last time, Lodge 49. I did ask the creators whether there was going to be some kind of genre element in the end of the season, because they hint that the original Lodge 1 in London, is kind of ominously, visualized in the first few episodes. And they're like, no, it's just, it's weird, but they're not going to, it's terrestrial. They're not going to, leave this realm and have like flying saucers, but
it's just not Twin Peaks.
No, it's rooted in reality, but just a kind of a skewed reality. And I think that those are a really good 1-2 pair. And Saul is kind of magnificent. And the one thing I want to say about Saul, There's no spoilers for season four in my review. There is a few and one huge one for season three. So if you haven't watched that, you might want to skip it. But if you have seen Saul, one of the things I pointed out in my review that I'm now looking forward to is I think the very distinct possibility that we will have another spinoff when that show ends. And it'll be about Gene and his, I mean, they could keep calling it Better Call Saul, but he's not going to be Saul by then, right? We already saw the whole, who Saul is in Breaking Bad, and Gene, who is in Omaha at the Cinnabon in Black and White in the first four seasons. I think his story is, we've seen so much of it now, it has to be told. I can't imagine them not wanting to tell it.
Yeah, that's it just keeps on going. Although that's the right way to do it, right? You tell a story and then you tell another story and then you tell another story, and you can keep the band together in terms of the production crew, but you don't have to, you can just follow those story threads one at a time.
Yeah. And I thought it was a beautifully well done, like, way to get to introduce Better Call Saul originally by flashing forward from the Breaking Bad finale. And I thought that was, and then their use of black and white and kind of the forlorn nature of Gene, aka Saul, is a great precursor to the more upbeat Jimmy McGill character, who that's his real name, we see in Better Call Saul. And I didn't think that there was a point to that, but now after fourth season in a row, that to me that was the tipping point. I mean, I knew they were going to do it, but the story evolves in a way as you watch the first, you know, 4 or 5 minute intro in Black and White where it's Gene's story. The story has evolved to a point where, like, I can't imagine them not telling this story. So they do have a built-in series going forward.
Fascinating. Let's see. Anything else? I don't know if there's anything else that we need to cover. Anything coming to mind?
No, just that I'm happy to be back and not in LA. That's it.
Yeah,
basically.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Totally. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, hey, maybe we should do some letters then.
Let's do that. Let's bang a couple
out. Mm-hmm. Here we go. So this is from John, who says, Tim and Jason, I hope this reaches you in time for this week's podcast, however you define this week. Interesting. An online cultural political site, which shall remain nameless, flat out ripped off the power rankings, title included. For reasons related to the right side of their slash line, I've been monitoring this site for a few years. In my opinion, it appears they're being underwritten by Russia. So these bastards are not only a propaganda arm of the Kremlin, they've appropriated Tim's signature literary riff, Commissar of Culture. Indeed, I'm thinking this affair would make for a good scripted comedy or reality thriller. That's a lot of genres there. An NSA agent teams up with a rogue TV critic to thwart Russians and their mission in Hollywood. Anyway, to further peaceful relations, the TV reviewers for this publication did make an intriguing recommendation, probably paid for in rubles, a show on NBC called Trial and Error, Lady Killers. I'm down to Netflix and network fare. Is this one worth plugging my TV set in for? I think you answered your own question, John.
No, not at all. But I'm not happy about this rogue site ripping me off.
No, that's no good at all.
I'm going to have to find out who this is and mock them.
It's a Russian plot, obviously.
Clearly.
Because the only power ranking should be either sports-related or yours.
Yes, it's sports-related or TV. I was there first. Anybody wants to fight me for it, break out the Russian nesting dolls.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
All right, this is from Martha in the 925. She says, welcome back. Earlier this summer, Art wrote in about how in this peak TV era, the likelihood of people developing near obsessive knowledge of TV shows has lessened due to too many new and good shows and not enough time to see them all, much less rewatch. That reminded me of an email sometime last year or before where the writer lamented there wouldn't be that common cultural knowledge of TV show trivia to share with our peers. Tim, you weren't saddened by this development, and I had to laugh. Like both of you, I'm also a Gen Xer, and though my Star Trek knowledge doesn't come close to that of Jason's, I have too much Brady Bunch minutia lodged in my memory due to endless reruns. It's fun to reminisce about the Love Boat, Fantasy Island lineup on ABC in the 70s and 80s with other similarly aged people, but I'm more than happy at the number of better choices out there. Martha from the 925. So not a question, just an observation from Martha.
Solid, Martha. And yeah. I agree. I think it's better. I mean, it's going to take over. You know, you won't have these trivia nights at these pubs are going to take a real hit. But maybe they'll all be about Star Wars and stuff like that. But
yeah, maybe. Netflix shows. Stranger Things.
Yeah, Netflix Stranger Things. You know, you can still mount it. There is still some shared cultural experience on the breakthrough hits.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I think because it's on demand now, actually, the people can dive right into one thing. Like I've said before, my daughter in The Office is a great example of that, that she totally is into it and rewatches those. And so I think that there will still be people who will have it, but it will be a little less shared except for the big crossover hits. But there's still something there. Okay, we're going to enter a sub-segment of the letters segment, Tim. This is a segment I like to call Letters Kenny, in which we read letters about Letterkenny, and we had a lot of them. So Carter from the 352 writes, I'd like to thank you for bringing the wonderful Letterkenny to my attention. In these times of confusion, this import from north of the border would surely have slipped under my radar, and I would never experience the joy of spending time with the Hicks, Skids, and Hockey Bros of Letterkenny. For your consideration, I would like to submit another show for Hidden Gems, Toast of London. Streaming on Netflix in the U.S., Toast of London originally aired in the U.K. on Channel 4 and stars Matt Berry as a stage actor and voiceover artist. Stephen Toast is his name. I like to think of Barry as the British Andre Brower due to the fact that every line of dialogue he delivers, no matter how mundane or outrageous, commands your attention and makes you feel like you're wrapped in a warm blanket. It offers extremely British hijinks, a character named Clem Fandango, mid-episode musical numbers, and a theme song written and performed by Barry that you'll be humming to yourself for the rest of time. Thanks for hours of entertainment and good luck with the Death March with cocktails. Okay, he survived, Carter. He survived. Carter from the 352. So there you go. Toast of London.
Nice. We'll add it to our list. Yes.
Yeah. All right. Also, we heard from TJ, who wrote, I'd heard some talk about Letterkenny, but hadn't sought it out until Tim's endorsement. The second episode, Fart Book, clinched my fandom. Upon doing a little research, I was stunned to learn that the creator, Jared Kiso, bases the show on experiences from his hometown of Listowel, a mere 45 minutes away from where I live. I found an interview in which Kiso says he took about half the slang from local practice, but he includes jargon from elsewhere as he encounters and is amused by it. I've never been so proud to be in the 519, signed TJ in Letterkenny country.
Yes, right down the block. That's where Jared is from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, Art from the 425 wrote in, regarding shows that might be similar to Letterkenny, if you wanted to find such a thing, you would have to look for a show featuring, I don't know, three quirky dudes and a gorgeous semi-promiscuous female who is also a sibling of one of the dudes. The characters would interact in their own tiny orbit with lots of witty, mostly off-color banter, and it would feature occasionally reoccurring external characters flowing in and out to add color. While each episode is its own little drama, the stakes are pretty low, and very little ever ends up changing in their world. Anyway, I don't know where you'd find such a show, but that would do it. On a separate topic, have you noticed that while the show is filmed in Canada, all the scenes so far have been in the summer, and it's always sunny in Ontario? That's weird, eh? Art from the 425.
Nice, Art. But I had that in my review, man. I already said that its cousin is distant cousin is always sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, that's right. It's always sunny in Ontario.
That was a clever little letter there.
Uh-huh. That was a good letter. Good, solid letter from Art.
Yeah.
And we will close out the letters, Kenny, and also it's a segue into our last email. This is from David in the +61, Australia. Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Uh-huh. Jason and Tim, a new experience for me from +61 free-to-air networks a few weeks ago. I was able to binge the full seasons of both Killing Eve and Counterpart on the on-demand apps of two different Australian networks. Neither show has run on their traditional free-to-air channels. It was the first time I have encountered this outside of Netflix and Amazon, but it seems to be something they have begun to do with a wide range of shows. Ooh. After that success, I was hoping I could catch up on The Expanse Season 3 on a real recent holiday in the 250, British Columbia. No luck. The series runs on the Space Channel, and it was showing episode 11, with the on-demand channel only offering the previous three episodes. Boo.
Boo, I hate that.
Another long wait for the full series to drop on Netflix for me here in the +61. And what's with Canadian bears walking on the ground? They barely climb trees. Have they no self-respect? David in the +61. So there's little drop bears. Information there. Yeah, that is the worst, isn't it? You can catch up on the last three shows, but no more.
Yeah, episodes 7, 8, 9. What? That's like the worst way to like sell your show.
Don't do that. It's very, very bad. I'm glad to see that our Australian friends are visiting Canada. That's nice.
I think that's great, too. And the letters Kenny, I love that. That was a really clever thing, Jason.
Letters Kenny. Canada. And so the last one is, last one's a Canada. It's Canada, but not letter Kenny, but it's a segue, because I have one last thing, which is that NJ Green on Twitter sent us a link to a story from CNN with the headline, "Mobs of Kangaroos Take to Streets of Australia's Capital Over Food Shortages." I hope there isn't a riot.
Oh my god,
those guys can punch.
Oh my god, kangaroos are freaks. You know that.
Yeah.
I mean, they're put into our culture as like bouncy little joy boxes. They are not. They're terrors. They're pugilistic, frightening, terrifying animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, don't go to Canberra is what I'm saying, because there are mobs of them there protesting food shortages. Apparently,
I love it. And you know what? That's a show. They're going to get themselves together in a gang. They're going into Sydney and they're going to kick some ass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. There are pictures in this story of just like 15 kangaroos on a lawn. it's quite scary. You know what, the drop bears will take care of it. They're gonna just clean them right up.
You know, I would totally watch a drop bears versus kangaroos throwdown, no question.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. All right. Well, if you would like to send in news of Australian animals or Letterkenny or anything else based on what we've talked about or something completely different, best ways to do it, you tweet at us at TVTM or you can email us at podcast@tvtalkmachine.com. Those are the best ways. And we are going to be back next week because it never stops. It never ends, Tim.
No,
it never ends. All right. But until then, thanks to everybody out there for listening. We're happy to be back. We're happy that Tim is back. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Goodbye.